Fanning. Weekends on 2FM.
Now, if I asked you to name the world's leading cause of death and suffering, what would you say it is? Well, you might say coronavirus, you might say cancer, or maybe you'd say heart disease. Well, in all cases, you'd be wrong. The answer is aging. So it begs the question, what would the world be like if we could cure aging? Well, scientist Andrew Steele has been looking at the medical and technological research being done to slow down the process of aging. He's written a book called Ageless, and he joins me now to talk about it. Andrew, welcome to the programme. We grow old. It's a universally accepted part of the human experience, right? It is, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I guess it is part of the human experience, but what you find if you look around the animal kingdom is that aging very much isn't a law of biology. The reason there's a tortoise on the cover of my book is that tortoises are one of the animals that appear not to age. So we all know, as humans, older people are more likely to die. Our odds of death double about every 7 or 8 years. But a tortoise, its risk of death is constant no matter how old it is. So that means it gets no more likely to die. And not only that, it gets no more likely to become frail, to get different diseases. It basically is ageless.
Okay, well, I'm going to get on to the story of Harriet a little bit later on. But before I do, the fact that we're not immortal, it drives an awful lot of our decisions. I mean, it comes to the very basis of who we all are. Why do we age?
Well, there are a variety of different underlying biological factors that go into this, and I break them down in the book into 10 hallmarks. Yeah. And they're essentially things like accumulation of damage to the molecules inside our body, changes to our cells, the loss of the ability for those cells to divide and that kind of thing. And then ultimately, all of these changes combine together to give us diseases like cancer and heart disease, to give us wrinkles and grey hair, basically to cause all of the different things that we associate with ageing.
Well, then, the most important biomedical question of our time, can we stop it?
We certainly can. And the exciting thing is we've got dozens and dozens of ways, mostly in the lab for now, where we can slow down and even reverse the aging of lab animals. I think the most exciting and probably thankfully also the easiest to explain is that we can use drugs to delete what are called senescent cells. These are aged cells that accumulate in all of our bodies as we get older. And if you give mice drugs that remove these cells, they basically get biologically younger. They live a bit longer, but they do so in good health. They get less cancer, they get less heart disease. They can run further and faster on a little mousy treadmill. They even have better fur. So what this shows is that it's really globally reversing that aging process. And the most exciting thing is that these drugs are already starting human trials.
Okay, well then, are we close? And if so, are we close to what? And extending our lives or a vastly improved older age?
We're close to potentially both of those things, because the fact is that if you do improve health in older age, you're going to live longer almost as a side effect. Because if you can postpone those diseases, the things like cancer, heart disease, dementia, all of the things that make life miserable when you get to those older ages, then ultimately, if you don't have those diseases, they're not going to kill you and you're going to live a bit longer as a side effect. And all these things I talk about, I'm very excited that they're going to happen within the lifetimes of people alive today. Those senolytic drugs, the drugs that kill the senescent cells that I talked about, we could be seeing the first of those in the clinic in the next few years, even if trials, go well first time round. And if not, it might take a little bit longer. But even the stuff that I talk about in the book about gene therapy, about stem cell therapy, things that can sound quite futuristic, these are definitely, more sort of 10 or 20 years away than a century or two centuries away. So it's definitely something that's relevant to an awful lot of people who are living and listening to this right now.
Well, you study the bodily system that declines with age, DNA, as you say, stem cells, immune system, etc. You are a computational biologist and science writer. Are you trying to develop therapies to reverse the trend, addressing the underlying process of aging itself?
So right now, I'm actually a full-time writer, because I decided, having spent 5 years or so in computational biology, that there was a real lack of understanding of the field, even within biology. So biologists, doctors, when they do their undergraduate courses, they often don't get a course in aging. And so the sort of huge potential of these things just isn't being realized. But luckily, there are lots and lots of groups all around the world. There are, scientists, research institutes, universities, even a growing number of private companies investing in this area and really trying to drive some of these treatments forward.
Well, then, is yours an audacious way of thinking, or is it standard common medical sense?
I think it can sound audacious when you first hear it, because as you sort of alluded to at the very start of this chat, aging is thought of as this sort of universal process. And even, as I say, within biology, it's thought of as for a very long time as an inevitable process of decline. But I think once you've shifted your mindset around and realized that these changes that happen as we age are fundamentally the things that are responsible for all these diseases that, anyone would absolutely love to see any progress towards a cure for, then suddenly it just seems like the logical extension of modern medicine to me.
And is vast life extension inevitable?
I think at some point, yeah, because, you know, I'd be astonished if I, you know, took a time machine to the year 3000 and there weren't people living vastly, vastly longer lives than we are now. I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, people alive today are going to live to 1000 or, you know, 120 even. We just don't know because it depends how the science pans out. But I think ultimately, you know, we're going to want to get rid of all these diseases. There's nobody who wants to get cancer next year or get dementia next year. And as you start to push those things further and further back into the future, there is going to come a point where people are living a very long time indeed.
And do you take a look at the whole thing, the whole picture all the time? I mean, it's not just treating one disease at a time. It's actually treating the aging process itself.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the real paradigm shift here, because the way that we deal with medicine at the moment, you know, if you get cancer, you might find a lump, you might go and see a GP, they might refer you to a cancer specialist, who'll give you some chemotherapy, maybe you'll have some surgery. We treat it all in these silos. But the problem is most people who get cancer, they're old. So they have all kinds of other things wrong with their body at the same time. They might have their first stages of cognitive decline. They might have, you know, some heart problems already. And so ultimately, even if you can cure that cancer, there are other things waiting in the wings to, you know, sap away their quality of life and ultimately go on to kill them. But by treating the underlying causes of all of these diseases at once, we can slow down or even reverse that process and make it much more likely that we can live healthier into old age.
Okay, by the way, our text is 51552. We're talking to Andrew Steele, and the fascinating book is called Ageless: The New Science of Getting Older Without Getting Old. At the start of this to now, do you think the field of aging biology has moved from hope to promise?
Definitely. It's really changed. You know, even if I'd written this book 5 years ago, there would have been, you know, there are things that we just didn't know, experiments that hadn't been done. But we're just every year, more and more papers are coming out that show us a whole multitude of different ways that we can slow down and reverse aging in the lab. And I think that's what really excites me about this. This isn't just, you know, one particular treatment that can do something. And then, you know, because the problem is with medical research, we've cured cancer in mice so many times. It's so frustrating that, you know, often they just, that these treatments don't make it into humans for all kinds of complicated reasons, where perhaps our physiology isn't quite the same as the mouse, or perhaps it just doesn't work for no obviously discernible reason, because biology is really hard. But the good thing is we've got literally dozens of ways to do this for aging. We can change the diet of animals, we can change their genes, we can give them drugs. There are even some macabre experiments where they sew old and young mice together and find that the old mouse gets rejuvenated. And, you know, all of these things are acting on the body of the older animal in very, very different ways. So that means that, you know, it would be wildly unlucky if literally all of these bets didn't come off at some point in the not too distant future.
And how did you sort of end up where you are now? Because, you know, you were at the Francis Crick Institute. What did you learn there?
Oh, it's a fascinating and bizarre story, mine, because I actually started out as a physicist. I did a PhD in physics at the University of Oxford. And at the end of that PhD, I started reading all this stuff about aging biology. And actually, I often tell people that I changed career because of a graph. And that graph is the slightly morbid one that I suggested earlier, which is this graph that shows how likely you are to die as you get older. And so humans' risk of death, as I mentioned, doubles every 7 or 8 years. And that means that if you're in your 30s, I'm about 35, that means that my risk of death every year is somewhere around 1 in 1,000. But if you keep on doubling that every 7 or 8 years, not much happens for, you know, decades, 2 decades, 3 decades. By the time you're 80, your risk of death is about 1 in 20 every year. And if you're lucky enough to make it into your 90s, your odds of not making your next birthday are somewhere around 1 in 6. That's death at the roll of a dice. And so that, you know, it could be quite a morbid and depressing realization. But actually what it made me think as a scientist was there must be some fundamental underlying process driving this enormous risk of death that basically smashes into us all at once as we start to, you know, get above the age of 70. And that's what compelled me to change fields.
Okay, death at the roll of a dice, 1 in 6. Okay, so are we talking here like a very fast developing science of longevity? That's really what it is. Like, are we on the road to powerful medicines?
We certainly are, yeah. And as I said, I think this really has transformed in the last 5 or 10 years, because we've got so many different approaches. These senolytic drugs that I mentioned are going to be available potentially in the next few years. And scientists are already starting to lay the groundwork for the next generation of therapies. So there's going to be a trial starting soon in the US. Unfortunately, it's been delayed a bit thanks to coronavirus, but looking at a drug called metformin, which is a diabetes drug that actually quite a lot of your listeners might be familiar with. They might take themselves, they might have relatives that take this drug, because it's one of the most widely prescribed drugs in the world. But what's really cool is that we've discovered that it doesn't seem to actually just affect diabetes. It seems to have some effect on other parts of the aging process, things like cancer and the risk of death overall. And so there's going to be a trial giving it to people who haven't got diabetes, people who are healthy in their 60s, and they're going to give half of them the actual metformin, half of them a placebo pill that has no active ingredient, and see who lives longer. And the exciting thing about about this trial isn't so much that, you know, metformin is going to double all of our lifespans, because even the scientists who are running this don't think it will. But the idea is that it's going to try and reduce regulatory barriers. It's going to mean that the FDA, the drug regulator in the US, is able to authorize a drug for use that doesn't treat a specific disease. It just tries to slow down the aging process. And once that barrier has been surmounted, then there could be, you know, that's going to open the floodgates for a whole load of new drugs, for pharmaceutical companies to start to get involved in this field. And it's really going to change the world, I think.
Okay, Andrew, is death necessary?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I've got a much more relaxed attitude to death than I have to aging. The thing that really bothers me, the thing that really motivates me to do something about aging, is the huge amount of suffering that precedes death in the way that it currently happens.
Right.
Because the fact is, you know, there's this sort of phrase that you can die of old age, and I think it's, you know, entered into sort of the popular lexicon. But the fact is that what that means is decades potentially of drawn out increase in suffering. You know, you become frail, you lose your memory, you know, you lose your independence effectively through a combination of different things. You lose your hearing, you lose your sight. And then you get these horrible diseases, things like heart disease. And, you know, most people don't just, you know, exist perfectly healthy, then suddenly fall over one day of a heart attack with no real pain.
Yeah.
Heart disease is a really, really slow killer. It stops you being able to, you know, play around with your grandkids, maybe stops you being able to get around the house and do your everyday chores until, you know, eventually it gets severe enough to take your life. And so death, that's a, you know, huge, fascinating philosophical can of worms. And is it necessary? It's not necessarily in and of itself a bad thing, but what I want is a much longer, healthier life.
Right,
it's the health span I care about.
Yeah, so but just say, like, is death necessary? Just let's say it qualifies, yes, but is aging necessary? A definite no.
Absolutely, yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, now let's just get on to a few examples here, because every year since 1840, maximum global life expectancy has increased by 3 months. 90% of the world's population live in countries where life expectancy is over 60. In India in 1950, not long ago, it was just 36. And, like, you know, the 20-year-old woman has a better chance of living to being to be a grandmum than a 20-year-old in early 19th century did of having their mother still alive. All of these things. And in the age of aging, it's estimated that 1 in 6 of global sort of population will be over 60 in 2050, and that's less than 30 years away. All of these things. Now, I mentioned earlier on Harriet. Harriet died of a heart attack. Tell me about Harriet.
Harriet is this absolutely incredible, iconic bit of sort of evolutionary biology and aging biology all rolled into one. She's a tortoise who's thought to have been collected from the Galapagos Islands by Charles Darwin, the father of the theory of evolution. And she made it back to England and then eventually to Australia, where she lived out most of her later years. And she outlived Darwin by over a century. So I mentioned earlier that tortoises have this risk of death that doesn't increase with time. And that means that she made it to the ripe old age of 175, basically with no loss of faculties, with no increase in frailty. And she just killed over one day of a heart attack, which I think is, you know, something we can all aspire to doing at 175 rather than 75.
Okay, but, like, we're talking about, do you call it senescence? Negligible senescence is what Harriet would have had. Is that it?
That's right, yeah. So that's this idea of a lack of increase of rate of death with time, a lack of increase of frailty. And it's not just tortoises. So we know tortoises have this. We know salamanders. There's even a tiny little species called the hydra, which is this sort of centimetre-long pond creature that has a risk of death that's so low. We've obviously not done the experiment to, like, watch it for this period of time to be absolutely sure. But we think if their risk of death continues the same in the future, into the future, 10% of those creatures would still be alive after 1,000 years.
Okay, so let's go from Harriet to humans. Well, hold on a second now. In 1800, again, not that long ago necessarily, would the average person be dead at the age of 40?
Yeah, that's the average. And that sort of, in some ways, hides as much as it reveals, because you know, what that really means is that about half of people didn't make it into their 20s, because there was such a huge toll of infant mortality from things like, you know, infectious disease was a huge killer, congenital problems that we just, you know, these days would be able to treat, but in those days just were a death sentence and so on. But if you did make it into your 20s, then a lot of people living in those days would have probably made it into their 50s, maybe their 60s, maybe even a few of them would have made it, you know, to what we these days would call old age. But that overall meant the average life expectancy was 40, which is just, you know, incredible to modern human eyes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, like, it's always a fascinating subject. And by the way, it's a fascinating subject in this book now, Ageless, The New Science of Getting Older Without Getting Old. And we're talking to the author, Andrew Steele. 51552 is our text. And when you look at the big screen, you know, Dr. Parnassus, or recently I saw one called The Age of Adeline with Blake Lively, which I thought was pretty good, actually. Interview with the Vampire, Anne Rice's story with the director Neil Jordan. Zardos, filmed here in County Wicklow. Death Becomes Her, Highlander, Deadpool, you know, Groundhog Day. You know, we can live forever, or can we? Anyway, sometimes some of those movies, they couldn't live forever. But have you looked back at the history of it all, alchemists and looking for elixirs for immortality of travellers' fountains of ever? By the way, the Tiernan Og here in Ireland, I think it's true. I don't think it's mythological at all. Basically, you know, no one grows old and no one gets sick. Have you looked through all of that stuff?
Oh, there's an absolutely incredibly checkered history of this stuff, isn't there? And I think that's one of the problems that we as sort of the modern field of biogerontology, this sort of modern biology of aging, have to overcome. Because over literally thousands of years, you know, the elixir of life has been something that loads and loads of people have been searching for in a variety of, you know, basically crazy ways, because none of this stuff in the past, we didn't really know what aging was on a biological level. So all these ideas were just, you know, completely without evidence and often quite unpleasant. I think the worst thing I came across was the suggestion that was popularized in the 1920s, so really quite recently, that you could increase your healthy lifespan by sewing monkey testicles to humans, which is really a terrible outcome for both the human and the monkey, frankly, and obviously has absolutely no basis in fact.
Wait a minute, that's not true. I've got to stop doing that then. What was I going to say? basically, new techniques of gene editing are going to optimize the good stuff. It'll reduce, I presume, the bad stuff and add new capabilities to, is it to our cells, to our organs?
Yeah, because I think the fact is that evolution, when it designed our bodies, when it designed all of our genes, it didn't really care about us making it to a ripe old age, because all evolution's bothered about is that you pop out some kids. You know, it's sad, unfortunately. The way that evolution sees you is that you're basically a vessel for sperm if you're a man, or babies if you're a woman. And everything else, it's not really so bothered about. And so that means that once you've had your babies, it's happy to let you degenerate and die. And what that means is that we are going to have to, you know, if we want to try and extend healthy lifespans, we're going to have to give the human body capabilities that it doesn't currently have. So one example is we might be able to give you some genes that would allow you to break down waste products that currently, you know, accumulate so slowly that they only go on to kill you in your 60s or 70s or 80s. So evolution's never equipped us with any tools to deal with that. But if we want to live longer and healthier, we're going to have to break down those, you know, those sort of toxic byproducts of metabolism. So we're going to have to give ourselves additional genes to try and do that potentially if we can't work out a way to do it with drugs.
Well, I suppose one of the questions might be then, how can you live long enough to live even longer? That might be one of the questions. You know, I presume it's not good for smokers, not good for people who eat too much food.
Definitely, yeah. I think a lot of the health advice, I've got a chapter entitled exactly that, How to Live Long Enough to Live Even Longer, in the book. Yeah. And, you know, some of the health advice is surprisingly basic. It's things like don't smoke, it's, you know, don't eat too much, get plenty of exercise. But I think that looking at it through the prism of the biology of aging has really transformed the way that I've approached my own sort of looking at my own health. The first thing being that understanding the biology behind it really sort of, it reinvigorates some of that tired old advice with new life, because you've got a much better understanding of why it is and how it is exactly that you should implement those things in order to optimize them. Secondly, it shows you some rather unconventional bits of health advice. So understanding the biology of aging actually revealed to me that brushing your teeth is one of the best things that you can do potentially for the health of your heart and the health of your brain, which is just something that without that understanding seems completely disconnected. And thirdly, the reason the chapter is called that is that because if you do optimize your lifestyle, try and, you know, live as well as you possibly can, you can live long enough to live even longer. Because if you can live longer in good health, I'm hoping that means I'll be able to live to a point where we, you know, we give more time for these treatments to be developed. So if I can make it, you know, healthy into my 80s, that means I might be healthy enough to, you know, receive some treatment for the biology of aging that's currently on the drawing board and might have made it into production by the time I get that old. So that's just another incentive to try and stay as healthy as possible.
And even though this is a very general statement, but eating less, does it slow down the aging process? I mean, rats ate what they wanted and they died younger. Is it the same true? Is it true for humans?
That is a fascinating question. I think for most of us in the modern Western world, because unfortunately we've got very easy access to lots of fat and sugar and, you know, lots of calories, most of us could do is shedding a few pounds. But the fascinating question in the aging biology field is whether we should take it even further and dramatically cut back the amount of food we eat. And as you sort of alluded to, there have been experiments not just in rats, but in mice, in worms, in flies, in dogs, in single-celled organisms like yeast, all of which show that by eating radically less, these creatures can live longer, healthier lifespans.
Okay.
The problem is, that's fine.
No, go on. The problem is what?
The problem is that, you know, when we try and implement this in long-lived species, the closest we tried to humans is rhesus monkeys. We found that the effect was a lot more ambiguous. So we just don't really know whether it's going to work in humans or not.
Okay, well then, we're talking cutting-edge research here. The first person to achieve immortality may already have been born. Discuss, Mr. Steele.
Well, I'm always very cautious about the use of the word immortality, because the fact is that even if we cure aging, you know, we cure, effectively therefore cure cancer, heart disease, stroke, dementia, etc., then you're still going to be able to get hit by a bus. You're still going to be able to get, you know, COVID-19 or whatever the next disease is. And so I think, you know, immortality could be a, you know, fair way away into the future. Maybe we're going to have to upload ourselves into computers or something, you know, far more bizarre and something that I, you know, personally find a bit weird. But I think that there's a strong possibility that people born now could live substantially longer, healthier lives. And the reason for that is what we were just talking about in this sort of, when we were talking about the health advice. Imagine you know, that you're alive now, you're middle-aged now, and you're in relatively good health. It's very plausible that you're going to be alive by the time the first senolytics, these senescent cell killing drugs, are on the market. And if you can, you know, live well, if you can exercise, if you can take some of these senolytic drugs to extend your lifespan a bit more, maybe metformin, that drug I mentioned, turns out to extend lifespan a bit as well, so you can benefit from that. That means you might live an extra, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years optimistically in good health. And that then means that those 5 or 10 years buy you time for more treatments to be developed.
Right. So metformin, metformin is the diabetes drug that you mentioned, and analytics kills off old cells.
That's exactly right, yeah. And the idea would then be that, you know, if you can live long enough to then allow new treatments to be developed that can then make you live even longer, then that I think ultimately is how we're going to cure aging. Because, you know, the idea of, when you talk about curing aging, it sounds like we're going to develop a little pill, you're going to take it, and that, you know, time will just stop.
Yeah.
But I think what's really going to happen is that we're going to get to a point where we're developing medical treatments sufficiently fast that, you know, life expectancy is going up by more than 1 year per year. And what that means in practical terms is that your funeral is receding into the future faster than you're chasing it, effectively. And, you know, while I don't necessarily think that's going to happen in the next 20 years or in the next 50 years, it's definitely, I think, the way that aging is ultimately going to be cured.
Wow. Okay. Well, I think people will want to read this one. Ageless, the new science of getting older without getting old. It's by Andrew Steele. It's out now. And one last thing I want to ask you, Andrew, is this. Japan has the largest number of centenarians. Why?
That is a very good question. There's some evidence that it might be related to diet. There's some, you know, it could be something to do with their genetics. It could just be that they're quite a wealthy country and, you know, they've done particularly well. So I think ultimately what you've got to do is remember that we can look around the world, we can find these places where people live longer and shorter, but the single biggest determining factor as to how long most of us live in good health is going to be how much progress we make in this field of aging biology.
Indeed it will be. You're right. Andrew, thank you so much for talking to us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.